Not a lot of people like bureaucracy. I don't blame them. It's slow, frustrating, and often feels like an obstacle rather than a tool. But for all its flaws, bureaucracy is kind of important. It's how we make sure decisions are fair and rules are followed so that people don't just make up things as they go along. This tension, however, is especially clear in housing. Right now, there's a growing push to cut red tape around housing development, especially in big cities, where supply is not keeping up with demand. But in these conversations, it's important to understand how bureaucracy interacts with accessibility, because for people with disabilities, bureaucracy is a double-edged sword. It creates essential protections, but at the same time, it also creates barriers. So, how do we balance efficiency with equity? And what happens if we don't? In this episode, we'll explore the impact of bureaucracy on community housing for people with disabilities and what this means moving forward. I'm Megan Miller.
I'm Zachary Weeks.
And this is
Accessing Home.
I have a walker, I have a cane, I'm fighting to get a scooter right now, but they won't give me a scooter till I get approval for the ramps. I don't have the ramps because they say they don't allow ramps. They don't allow lifts. They don't allow anything that takes away from the original design of the unit. Well, does that include the mold I lived with for 6 years in the walls too? Or the asbestos in my ceiling?
This is Krista Christensen.
I've lived in Civita housing for almost 30 years now and raised 5 children in it. I've done everything from coach community soccer to be a family support worker to, oh heck, I think during COVID, for most of it, I was running a food bank out of my house. So I'm kind of the one that everybody goes to around here.
Krista has multiple sclerosis, or MS for short.
I was diagnosed at an incredibly young age. Why it was missed when I was younger and through my teens, I don't know. Probably because you didn't hear the word MS a lot back then. I know when I first got my diagnosis at 21, I was shocked because I honestly didn't know what MS was. You know, I had this doctor say, okay, well, you have MS, don't get married, don't have kids. You're probably going to be in a wheelchair, you know, by the time you're X amount years old. So basically, you're not going to have a life. I didn't really like what he had to say. So I just kind of said no and thought he was crazy and went on my way. And then I have a son who was born with autism. We pretty much knew that, but he was high functioning and nobody wanted to help us. No doctors, no pediatricians, because he wasn't autistic to the point where he was nonverbal, laying on the floor, rocking back and forth. So I literally broke down actually 2 years ago and had to borrow money to get him privately diagnosed. So I just think people need to start thinking outside the box instead of trying to throw everybody in the box and say that everybody has to do something a certain way because it's not working, right? So that's pretty much who I am. And as for that, my other children are all grown up, moved out of the house, and are very successful in life and their careers. So there you go. But now my focus is just on trying to provide the best life I can for my son.
Krista and her son live in a Civita townhouse. And while it's been their family home for a while now, it's nowhere near accessible. The unit is split between 2 levels. The kitchen and living room are on the main floor, while the bedrooms and the only bathroom are upstairs. This means that Krista has to navigate a steep set of stairs just to do basic daily tasks. And if she wants to leave the house, there's another set of steps at both the front and back doors, all of which are a challenge.
MS doesn't discriminate. You can't control it. So I may wake up and fall flat on my face because my legs don't want to work that day. Right? It doesn't care that I have a son to take care of. It doesn't care that, you know, I have things to do. It doesn't care.
There are solutions that can help. Home modifications like ramps or stair lifts would address these issues. And Krista even qualifies for funding to install them. But she's hit roadblock after roadblock in trying to get them approved in her unit.
It's incredibly hard because you have, you know, home care coming in and assessing you and going to bat for you, and there's social workers and nonprofit agencies and saying, okay, she needs a ramp, she needs this, and then there's the ramp program, and you filled out the paperwork, and you got either got get, you know, housing to sign off on it or one of the representatives to sign off on it, and they know you need it, but they're being told, no, we don't do this. We don't allow any ramps or lifts or anything done to our units. And it's like, okay, well, you obviously don't understand federal and provincial law because I have rights here. And so I personally have found that in order to get anything that I may need out of housing, I literally have to get a lawyer involved. So the question that I have is, why do I have to go to such great lengths to get these people to realize, hey, I need a lift? Or, hey, I need a ramp? Or, hey, I can't have mold in my house for 8 years.
In Alberta, like the rest of Canada, housing providers have a duty to accommodate. They're required to make reasonable efforts to ensure equal access for people protected under the Human Rights Act, which includes people with disabilities. They're also expected to respond in a way that's both reasonable and timely. But what counts as reasonable and timely is kind of open to interpretation, and that's where things get tricky.
You're right. It's completely subjective. And what would those folks do if that was them in that situation? And this is where I go back to, we gotta be more compassionate, more empathetic, and put ourselves in the shoes of other people across the board, whether it's disability related or not, right? You know, to me, timely is, you know, a week, 2 weeks, and then you're off and running again. Well, rolling in my situation. But it should not take years to get a ramp or a stairlift if you qualify. You know, what if I was the person that says, well, you know, you can use the main floor. We'll see how it goes with the basement. You know, like, we'll decide. You know, if you're using all your space in the main floor, maybe you can expand to the basement, right?
Yeah. Weird trial period.
Yeah, right? And we'll decide if, you know, and how much of the basement you can use. And then we'll let you know when you can use it.
Yeah.
We'll do it in a timely manner.
I think what's so infuriating, too, is that for the people that I talk to, like, oftentimes the housing provider doesn't even have to pay any money. Mm-hmm. All they have to do is
sign off.
And yet,
stroke of a pen makes a world of difference. And it's impacting people's lives beyond what you can imagine. Right? Yeah, I mean, there needs to be stronger enforcement better codes, stronger codes, stronger policies, stronger, like, pride in your work. Like, this is what you're prideful of. The bare minimum. Come on. Like, geez Louise.
I want to be clear. We are not suggesting that Savita is intentionally denying people accommodations or acting out of malice. As a government-supported housing provider, they operate within strict rules and liability constraints. And this might mean they require specific documentation to verify a claim or have to get approval from multiple offices before they can respond, even for a seemingly simple request. But these safeguards come with real consequences. As the legal principle goes, justice delayed is justice denied. Even when accommodations eventually come through, the delay itself causes harm.
They fought with me for 6 months about getting that ramp on my house. They didn't even have to pay for it. They just had to assign to people that it was okay. And then they fought with me about, oh, you have to have an electrician come in and change out your light switches and but you can't even tell me what kind of light switches to get. Because I wanted to convert it to the Alexa system because of my disability. I want to adapt things to my conditions. But you're giving me a problem every single time I try and adapt something for my physical needs.
This is Skylar Morgan. We heard her in episode 1 when discussing the importance of accessibility and affordability. As you might recall, she has fibromyalgia, which limits her mobility, and she also lives in a Savita 2-level split.
If we had a townhouse that was on the main floor, it would be better. But, they said the only thing like that is an apartment, but I won't move back into an apartment. They're infested with bed bugs. They're infested with cockroaches. And I'm sorry, I don't like those kind of bugs. You know, I've asked them and asked them to make things more accessible for me. Like having a stall that's closer to my house. So for me to get to the parking stall, I have to go down those 3 stairs on my walking device, which is a scooter, technically. Go down those 3 stairs. Then I have to get into the parking lot, go around every car to get out to my car, which is on this side, because there's a little.
Just a note for listeners, Skylar made the motion of a dip with her hands to explain the barrier.
I have to go through Boardwalk's complex to get to my house. I should be able to get in my own complex without having to go down a bunch of stairs all the time. So there's no curbs in this complex at all. It's dirty as hell, and there's glass everywhere. And, you know, like, health reasons, there, like, for a lot of us, there's black mold in a lot of the units. There's not in this unit, thank God, because I'm very cleanly. And I made sure I had a health inspector come in here, and there was black mold at one point. They had to rip out a bunch of stuff in the bathroom. But that's the other thing, they're just so cheap. Like, my bathroom, the bathtub needed to be replaced a long time ago. Where they enameled it, and now it's chipping everywhere. So I have to pull it out of my hair all the time. And with dreadlocks, that's hard, you know, and I've had so much problems with that bathtub since I got here. Like, it's not even just the enamel's chipping, it's like, every time I turn on the water, and I know there's a leak in there, but they tell me there's not. Well, I'm sorry, every time I turn on the water, I can hear the leak in the wall. Drip, 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 drip. And the other thing, a lot of the units have yellow water here. When I first moved in here, I had yellow water. I had to get them to come in and re-pipe the pipe. Because I wouldn't drink it, I wouldn't bathe in it. I'm like, I'm not staying here, and I know you didn't do this. And I said, I will call the health inspector, and I will have this unit shut down, and the whole complex could shut down. Technically, this complex should be shut down.
I wanted to weave Skylar back into our conversation because her experience highlights another challenge, aging infrastructure. How bureaucracy doesn't just show up in paperwork or delayed approvals. It's built into the walls. Most of Edmonton's community housing was built in the 70s and 80s. And in the last episode, we discussed how the age of these buildings contribute to inaccessibility. But it also points to something deeper, a system that's been underfunded and neglected for decades.
You know, everything's falling apart in this complex, so it's very unsafe. And I'm like, I've told them over and over and over what they needed to do, and it's like it keeps falling on deaf ears, or they just don't really give a fuck. But it's indicative of all levels of government, and this is a level of government. This is government housing. It's funded by the City of Edmonton and the government of Alberta. So they both need to be accountable. And right now, Mayor Soji and Danielle Smith are slumlords. They are slumlords, plain and simple.
It's really easy to see these as failings of one housing provider or one administration, but we need to remember it's not that simple. The delays and disrepairs we're seeing today, they're symptoms of a system that's been shaped by decades of policy decisions. And to understand how we got here, we need to take a step back and examine the history of community housing in Canada.
Many people trace the origins of community housing to the 1940s, when the Government of Canada established Wartime Housing Limited. This was in the early 1940s, and these were homes that were intended for people working in the wartime economy, and later for veterans who were returning from World War II. A few years later, in 1949, the first public housing projects were established in Canada. These were in cities like Halifax, St. John's, and in Toronto, where Regent Park, perhaps the most widely known and talked about public housing project, was built.
This is Dr. Joshua Evans.
I am an associate professor of human geography at the University of Alberta.
And for transparency, he's also one of my master's supervisors. His research focuses on disability and chronic illness, along with housing as a whole.
I began doing research on homelessness, and most people connect homelessness to a shortage of affordable housing. And many people would put forward the idea that housing is the solution for homelessness. So naturally, I've been moving to study housing and community housing in particular as a way of addressing our houselessness crisis here in Canada.
Community housing in Canada really started to take shape in the post-World War II era. And to understand what that looked like in practice, I want to take a quick detour to Toronto, specifically to Regent Park, which was designed to replace overcrowded and deteriorating buildings.
Down came Oak Street. Down came the verminous walls, the unclean, unhealthy rooms. And down came the fire hazards, the juvenile delinquency, the drunkenness, the broken marriages. And up rose something new, the nation's first large-scale public housing project, to be called Regent Park.
This is a clip from Farewell Oak Street. It's a documentary from 1953 that the National Film Board of Canada produced to show the benefits of housing redevelopment.
Rents based on income. Kelly the pensioner, $29 a month. Brown the truck driver, $45 a month. Jakes the toolmaker, $75 a month. Brown paying a little for Kelly, Jakes paying a little for them both. And the people of the city and the rest of the country putting in a share.
So this film is definitely a time capsule for a different era. But it shows how community housing began as a way to both address public concern over slum housing and to bring families into a kind of post-war prosperity.
They're all there, the Kellys, the Hansons, the Tweeds, 1,300 families, old and young, large and small, poor and not so poor.
What's queer here, too, is that community housing was intended to capture a broad sweep of people that, you know, we would call ordinary working class families.
Community housing has evolved significantly since then. And this followed different concerns that were raised. So not only about the quality of housing, but also about the supply of housing. So in the 1960s, late 1960s and early 1970s, there was growing concern about the shortage of affordable housing. And so the federal government and provinces began developing programs. And the outgrowth of many of these programs in the 1970s were some significant investments in nonprofit and cooperative housing. And these investments were really important. It was during this period that we saw a boom in the construction of housing operated by nonprofits and cooperative housing in cities across Canada. Later, concerns shifted slightly towards the affordability of housing. And so in response, federal and provincial programs began to adjust to address the concerns regarding the actual affordability of housing for people on very low incomes. Now, I should say, though, over this time, over the 1970s and 80s and into the 1990s, these programs and the investments that followed were often very piecemeal. They're often very reactive. And so while it's important to acknowledge the gains that were made during these periods, it's also important to acknowledge that today we have a community housing sector that's roughly 3.5 to 4% of the total housing stock. And so many people, when they're reflecting back on the history of community housing in Canada, when they're describing the programs that were developed over the many decades, they often draw attention to that piecemeal and reactive nature of our community housing policy. And they often use terms like residualism to describe the character of the community housing that we've inherited after those many, many decades. And this term residualism was developed to describe the fact that the stock that we have today and the way it is operated is really reserved for those who are most in need. And in that regard, we have this very small stock that's a housing of last resort, so to speak. Whereas in other countries, other more developed countries, we can find examples of housing systems with much larger proportions of social and affordable housing.
So even though community housing policy from the 60s onwards was always piecemeal and kind of reactive, it was the 1990s that was hugely transformational.
Many people apply the term neoliberalism or the neoliberal turn in public policy to describe this moment. But essentially what we experienced was two things. First, the federal government devolved responsibility for many of the federal housing programs that they were operating to the provinces. What followed that was deep cuts to funding that was directed to these programs. And those cuts continued onwards. And the end result was a significant reduction in the growth of community housing and new supply, as well as a whole host of additional issues related to the way that programs operated and the quality of the housing stock itself.
And even though the federal government reinvested in housing in 2017, this has ongoing ripple effects.
So we have a scarcity of social and affordable housing in Canada. And an easy way to verify this is just to look at the wait lists for subsidized housing. So in a city like Edmonton, there's thousands of people, and many of whom have been on those wait lists for years. And so this scarcity just speaks to the lack of supply or the shortage of supply of community housing. The second issue that isn't new, but has existed for many, many decades, is the affordability of community housing itself. And so many nonprofit housing providers really struggle to deliver units that are subsidized to the extent or to the degree that many households require. So here we're talking about those deeply subsidized units. And it's difficult for some nonprofit housing providers to deliver these units because they're concerned with the sustainability of their programs. And this sustainability is a challenge as a result of many of the cutbacks that occurred during that neoliberal moment, you know, 20, 25 years ago or more. Related to both of these issues is the quality of the housing stock. So much of this housing stock was constructed in the 1970s and 1980s. And like any type of housing, to ensure its quality over time requires investments. And lacking the funds and lacking those investments from governments, many of these housing providers in the sector have had to defer maintenance over time. And that has produced buildings and housing stocks that are in significant need of repairs. And this is an issue that's only growing over time.
It's clear that community housing needs more funding, but just as crucial is how that funding is allocated. A lot of money for community housing is directed towards new developments. And I get it, we need more housing, and those projects are politically appealing. But that also means that existing housing stock can often get overlooked, especially when it comes to routine maintenance, including snow removal. Here's Krista again.
So these are literally like the Colombian ice fields, okay? Well, if I can't walk out my front door without falling on my ass and going ass over tea kettle, Houston, we have a problem, right? And they're aware of it. And you'll get excuses as, well, there's no money in the budget. Or if you get them to come out and do it, it won't be till the snow starts to melt. And then they want to procrastinate even longer. Oh, it'll just melt away. Yes, and then we end up with the Titanic for 3 weeks. My parking stall's underwater. We can't get the garbage for the garbage bins. The sewer drains are plugged because they've been iced over because you didn't come scrape or clean the parking lot. So that's not accessible. I can't even get garbage to the garbage bin because there's no access without attempting to kill myself. But you take a look at all the other complexes, whether they're privately owned or whether they're rented. I mean, they're clearing the snow. The father of my children, he lives in an apartment complex just 5 minutes from me, just on the other side of Manning. And they cleaned last winter 4 times. They cleaned the snow out of that parking lot. And us, nothing. I have people that won't even come visit me because they can't gain access to my unit in wintertime. Huge problem, right? So sending in emails is what Leanne Jo's Bose did. She's on a different job now, but she was my case manager for the longest time for home care. Excellent woman. Didn't even get a response out of Civita, right? Like, phone the manager, phone the site supervisor. What do you want us to do about it? Well, I'm handicapped. I have to have people come in and take care of me. They can't gain access to the unit because you won't come clear the ice and the snow away. The ruts were so big that they were 3 feet deep. I'm not kidding. It's absolutely wild. And then I'm sitting here hearing that they're building new housing and I'm like, time out. You can't maintain the housing that you already have, that you haven't sold off. But we're just going to build new housing. Okay. Tell me how that's going to work.
Bureaucracy isn't unique to community housing. Larger systems in general come with more red tape. It doesn't matter if you're dealing with government-supported housing or a large property management company. The more layers there are, the more steps things tend to take. And again, as I mentioned before, bureaucracy actually does exist for a reason. There's good intent behind it. Standardization is supposed to ensure fair decisions, and hierarchical structures are designed to maintain order and accountability. And also, in the context of community housing, we can point to bureaucracy as being the reason why the sector is more accessible than market housing as a whole. So even though it sounds like bureaucracy is bad, it isn't inherently. The problem is that all of these systems are often ill-equipped to handle unique or complex situations. And unfortunately, it also places the burden on the individual to repeatedly prove their need, which costs time and money.
I don't think people should have to reach out to lawyers and agencies and get their doctors involved. And that's not what doctors' jobs are. Doctors' jobs are not to sit and write letters for age or income support or housing. Know what the problem is. Fix it. Stop trying to delay it. We only have X amount of money to live off of. And yet we have to pay doctors $100 to $200, in some cases, $600 just to fill out a piece of paper to say, hey, this is what we need. The system is broken. And it's very sad. And unless you're a fighter, you're not going to get anywhere in it. It took me 2 years just to get an approval to get a lift, right? And it's probably going to be another 6 months before it gets put in. Went through two surgeries without what I needed. That's hard, particularly if you don't have any friends or family to rely upon, and it's just me. That's the sad part, and I'm trying to do the best I can with my MS and my diabetes and all my other health issues, and then plus you add my son into the works, and it's just like, wow. Most people just give up, right? And their kids get taken from them because they can't take care of them, and they get put in a home, and you know, it just, we need to do better. And it's all joined and linked together. It is. Like, you know, people can run down Civita Housing. People can run down the government. But you need everybody to come together as a collective and a whole on how they're going to change this. And that's lacking, severely lacking. Because these agencies only get so much money and then it's every man for themselves. And it's the government really that's ultimately made it this way, right? We can create dissension and chaos and turn people against each other, then there won't be so focused in on what we're not doing. And this is where accountability goes out the window.
After all these conversations, one truth stands out. Community housing wasn't designed to fail people with disabilities. But it wasn't designed for them either. What Krista and Skylar are navigating isn't just bureaucracy. It's a values problem. Because bureaucracy isn't just paperwork. It's about power. About who gets to say yes or no, and who's forced to keep asking. And all too often, the people who need the most support have to do the most just to access their basic rights. Making community housing more accessible can't fall on people with disabilities. It has to be a collective effort, from providers to policymakers to builders, and yes, to us, the public.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, need I remind you that, you know, disability is the only minority group that a person can join at any time throughout their life. Overall, if we're investing in proper, accessible housing, sooner or later you're going to need it. Or a friend or a family member, chances are nowadays, most people listening to this podcast will know, if not already know, someone with a disability, because it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And, you know, there's all these intersections, and, you know, we need to really come together as one if we want to move in the right direction and move the needle in positive ways.
But here's the thing. The biggest barrier to accessibility isn't policy or design or even money. It's mindset. Who and what we value. Because that shapes everything else. So next time, we're going to explore how inaccessibility is an attitude problem. Accessing Home is created by me and is supported by Community Housing Canada, a research partnership funded by the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. My research is also supported by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council and the Royal Canadian Geographical Society. Music in this episode is from Blue Dot Sessions, a repository of free music for podcasters. It also features Hard Living by John Bartman from freemusicarchive.org. Big thanks to Krista Christensen, Skylar Morgan, and Dr. Joshua Evans for speaking with me in this episode. And thanks to Amanda Twellos for giving the gift of the podcast visuals and CJSR 88.5 FM for the use of their studios. I'm Megan Miller.
I'm Zachary Weeks.
Thanks for listening.